Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
And this is London, of course, but coming to you all over the world, thanks to the wonders of the internet. There's bare knuckle fighting, of course, in the US presidential election. Maybe even literally as well as metaphorically. And maybe it won't just be punches that are being exchanged. It is building up to a denouement which is pregnant with some of the most terrifying prospects since the Civil War, when Joe Biden had already been a senator for a decade or two. Joe Biden said he'd been in the Senate for 180 years, which means he may have been present, like Zelig, at the Gettysburg Address. But Donald Trump's goons, the armed white supremacists, the Proud Boys that he told to stand back and stand by, are going to be out on the streets on Election Day, which is only just over 3 weeks from now. Whether that will intimidate the voters into voting for their man remains to be seen. The American people are not easily intimidated. The election could go either way. There is, of course, a whole series of polls now that put Joe Biden very considerably in the lead. But let me tell you something, that from where I sit, and because I've been around a long time, I'm an expert in. In the 1980s, when Britain had a conservative prime minister, so divisive and so controversial, many people found it difficult to admit to strangers that they supported her. Thus, the phenomenon of the shy Tory came forth, where approached by a ponytailed, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, university-educated, obviously liberal and progressive young woman with a clipboard comes up and asks, "Are you voting for Margaret Thatcher?" There was a 5% at least who said no, or that they didn't know, when they knew fine well that they were going to. Now, if that was true of Margaret Thatcher, how true must it be about Donald Trump? If some Ivy Leaguer bounded up to you with a clipboard and said, "Are you voting for Donald Trump?" would you admit it? I'll warrant there are quite a few who will not. And so, I believe these polls are undercounting Donald Trump's support. But there's also this dichotomy, one which we have touched on over the weeks. The vast majority of Republican voters will vote in person on the day. Thus, every exit poll will show a big lead for Donald Trump. The counting of the votes in person will show a big lead for Donald Trump. Because most Democrats are voting by post, the mail-in voter, which is already completely shambolic. Hundreds, thousands, 50,000 this week in the state of Michigan got the wrong ballot paper by post. Now, I can see what's going to happen, can't you? Whatever happens in the postal vote, Donald Trump will claim that it was fraudulent, that it was so chaotic, shambolic, and downright corrupt, that he simply will not accept the result of a postal ballot defeat for him. And thus, the scene will be set for an ending which might be fitting, actually, given the chaos of Donald Trump's first term as president, that down on the street, things get very, very ugly indeed. Donald Trump has the support, it's widely acknowledged, of at least 40% of the American public. That 40% hold amongst them, between them, scores of millions of guns. Many of them more than one. Many of them not one of your pistols that you cock, but the heavy automatic kind of hardware. Down on the street, if it does get ugly, I back Trump's forces to be considerably more violent than the hippies and Black Lives Matter liberals that will be out on the street against them. A pussy hat ain't no defense against automatic weapons. And so the United States armed forces, their multiple armed forces, I couldn't begin to count how many armed forces they have, but up to and including the Army itself, perhaps the Marine Corps itself, could be on the streets of America dealing with the consequences of this unprecedented constitutional rupture, at least since the American Civil War when Joe Biden was a young senator. Now, all of that, of course, will have to end up in the court. Which court? I hear you say the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court that gave George W. Bush the presidency when his brother rigged the election in the state of Florida. George Bush was never the president of the United States, but he served two terms and he invaded half the world and he created an earthquake which is seismic still. And so what will that Supreme Court, newly emboldened by Donald Trump's right-wing picks, what will they decide? And if they decide that Trump won it, the Democrats will not accept that. And a profound political and constitutional crisis will exist in the most powerful, richest country on the earth. The richest and most powerful empire the world has ever seen will be in a state of armed chaos. Now, that might mean that the rest of the world gets a break. I can hear non-Americans listening to what I'm saying, shrugging their shoulders and saying that. And it could mean that, but it could mean worse than that. It could mean that in amidst all this chaos, some kind of wag the dog operation is mounted to try and still the chaos inside the country. And by that, of course, I mean a war. A war with, if anyone, the People's Republic of China. And that war is pregnant with the end of humanity itself, because no one should imagine that the People's Republic of China will accept to be shot at. Those days are well and truly gone. And if the missiles are arriving on Chinese territory, in Chinese waters, be sure that they will be returned and with interest. And therefore, this chaos I'm describing may not give the rest of us a break. It may be the occasion when the empire explodes rather than implodes. These are very serious, dark even, prospects. You may think I'm being fanciful, but I study this very closely. I'm on American television 5 nights a week, Monday to Friday, oftentimes with my first guest, Rachel Blevins. I study American politics very closely indeed, and I think I have my finger on the button. But we'll hear from her whether I'm being too apocalyptic or not. But bear in mind that Max Kaiser and many other of our guests and callers from the United States of America have been worried of late about exactly the same thing. The coronavirus is on top of all that. There are 57 million people in America unemployed. Get your head around that number. A wave of evictions is taking place because The people can't pay the rent to the landlord, and the landlord can't pay the bank for the loan with which he bought the property that he's let to the tenant. The economic vitals of the United States are not just creaking, they are splintering and may fall apart on top of the coronavirus, which has killed well over 200,000 people in the United States of America. And it's getting worse here too. Not yet in terms of hospitalizations, it's getting worse, but not to the point of overwhelming the National Health Service. Not in terms of mortality yet, mainly because most of the people who've just been infected, in a doubling of the number of infections in 1 week last week, have been young people whom we must hope and pray are strong enough to survive it without hospitalization, ventilators, intensive care beds, or mortality itself. The jury's out on that, but it isn't sadly out on the other aspects of this story. And we're going to have to confront it. When the facts change, so do my opinions. How about you? And the facts are now that in Britain and the United States, it may very well be that this virus is unbeatable. It may very well be that the opportunity cost of switching all of the shrunken, deliberately shrunken, resources of the National Health Service to dealing with the virus is leaving people to suffer and die in significant numbers from other complaints, other illnesses, other conditions, including mental health conditions. The number of suicides is rising in Britain. I'll be surprised if it isn't rising in the United States also. And then there's the economic cost. As I said at the beginning of the show, the great city of Liverpool, which is in my heart always, has just been closed down. Everything. Pubs, clubs, dance halls, music halls, casinos, bookies, bookmaker shops, turf accountants, I don't know what you call them in the United States, have all been shut down just like that because of the extraordinary spike in Liverpool and the surrounding parts of the northwest of England. In Scotland, the place where the First Minister has been boasting for months that she was handling it all so much better than the English. Everything is defined against the English. That turned out to be a gigantic lie. And the result of a deliberate cover-up of the reason why thousands of Scotland's old people died in care homes. A cover-up of the initial outbreak in the Nike conference in Edinburgh, which should have been used as a klaxon to alert the whole country to the seriousness of this, was instead covered up. Scotland is now the worst affected place in Britain, and Glasgow is the worst afflicted place in Scotland. And Glasgow, too, is in my heart. I represented it in Parliament for many years. I spent the best years of my life in the great city of Glasgow. But when you close down every pub and restaurant and cafe, except one limited form of cafe, I'm not even sure if the government knows who is exempt in the cafe field. Certainly the cafe owners don't. If you shut down the economy in Scotland for a problem that is overwhelmingly afflicting the Central Belt, but requires the closure in Orkney, in Caithness, in Sutherland, in the borders of Scotland, you are going to devastate the economy in a way that we'll still be suffering from decades from now. I spoke yesterday to an old friend of mine, a man in his 70s, but with a young 22-year-old son, just finished university, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, looking for work. There's no work. Nobody's hiring. the prospects for the economy in Britain and the United States is now so dire that it raises the question of whether or not we're going to have to radically U-turn on the measures that we are taking now and find another way. We'll be discussing that, of course, with the great Moats medic, Dr. Ranjit Brar, in the final hour. And in between times, we'll speak to a real artist, one of London's finest chanteuses. We'll be talking to her about arts, culture in the time of the coronavirus. Rising star. Trust me, she'll be in the Congress one day and not long distant. Rachel Blevins joins me now. Rachel, you're a brilliant commentator. You'd also be a brilliant politician. We badly need people like you, but I'll not put you in any difficulty with our employer by going further down that track. Tell us how Lazarus managed to rise from the tomb. Has he really risen? Is his blood really the vaccine? What did he mean by that? Has he gone entirely mad?
Well, I think the term of risen from the dead really does apply here, George, because we look at the timeline and we see that in the course of a little over a week, Trump went from testing positive to COVID-19 to being needed to be admitted to the hospital to then within a matter of days walking out. And now all of a sudden he's back to holding rallies and gatherings. And he's claiming, of course, that he feels better than he has in 20 years. And I'm sure he does because he received a cocktail of experimental drugs. He's under 24/7 care, so he likely does feel great right now. But at the same time, he's, of course, not out of the woods. And it's interesting to now hear him making all of these comments and telling people that the coronavirus is nothing for them to be afraid of, because for him, it likely isn't, because he's under such great care. But for the average American right now, who is looking at losing their job, losing their access to health care, even losing the roof over their head, they are concerned about what's going on, not just because of the virus, but also because of the impact that it's having here at home. So when you hear Trump making statements like that, sure, he's celebrating his own temporary victory, at least as long as we know, but he's also putting himself out of touch with his base right now that is really still struggling.
Well, I mean, ironically, he was treated in a fully socialist hospital. The Walter Reed Memorial Hospital is the acme of what a socialist hospital would be. It's free for him. It's free, actually, for everyone that's in it. It's just that everyone can't get in it. It's provided by the state. It's state of the art. It is everything that most American hospitals, and he is everything that most American patients are not. He has arisen. He's back on the streets. He's in the campaign. People are coming to listen to him. Neither he nor they wearing masks or even being particularly socially distanced. What does that all tell us?
Yeah, they're already having gatherings at the White House in the exact same place that they had that gathering just a couple of weeks ago, where he was looking at his new Supreme Court nominee, and a number of people tested positive for the coronavirus as a result of that. So every single person that is going to these gatherings is going there knowing that they could be coming into contact with the coronavirus, but also knowing that they likely don't have that same level of care that Trump has and that he has access to. So every single person that's taking part of that is taking a risk, but they're also adding to this ongoing myth that it's nothing to worry about, that it's, you know, it's okay, everything's fine, when the majority of Americans are not feeling that.
Well, don't discount this. It's long before our time, although Joe Biden was around in the Senate at the time. FDR won the election in the 1930s, 1935, I think, on the slogan, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And this, in a way, is what Trump is saying, that there's nothing to fear with the coronavirus except the fear of it. That may have traction that is not immediately obvious, but do you sense any movement in the polls towards him?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as you were bringing up earlier, the polls aren't always accurate, especially when you have a polarizing figure like Trump. And if we look back at 2016, we saw that Hillary Clinton was up above and far beyond in the polls. And there were people on the media saying, there's no way Trump can win, just look at the polls. Well, then we saw what actually happened. So I don't think that the polls are entirely accurate, but I also think that he really has something coming here with the fact that Congress has yet to come together to do anything about a second stimulus bill or, you know, anything in that realm. They've yet to give the American people any kind of relief. So you do have a lot of Americans that are sitting there pointing and saying, oh, well, Trump is trying to get something done, but the Democrats and Republicans in Congress claim that they just can't get together. So that may give him a little bit of an edge for all of those Americans who are sick and tired of it and who maybe do believe this promise that he's going to get them that second $1,200 check if and when he wins the re-election.
Yeah, I mean, he's dangling that as bait, isn't he? Now, tell me this, Rachel. If Trump wins, what do the Democrats and the liberals and the Black Lives Matter and the pussy hat multitudes and so on, what do they do? And alternatively, if Trump loses, what do the far more sinister forces that I talked about earlier, the white supremacists, the racists with machine guns and so on, what do they do?
Well, you are likely to see a lot more of those protests in the streets, especially as we're waiting for results here, right? Because we'll see the people that go out and vote, but a lot of these states are saying that they're not going to count those mail-in ballots, they're not going to count those absentee ballots until days after the election. So if we're talking about something that is super close whenever it comes to these votes, then we could likely see more protests in the streets, especially if you have Trump in the Oval Office saying, I've got this in the bag, I'm not leaving, I'm not going anywhere. And then you've got Biden saying, well, wait a second, we still have to count these ballots here, we still have to see what this state is doing and that type of thing. And you are likely to see a lot more protests and a lot of those very polarizing gangs. And you're right, exactly as you said earlier, some of them are very heavily armed. And when you're talking about a lot of these people in the South, they have been stocking up on ammo, they have all of their weapons, and not necessarily to be violent, but to do anything that they feel like is protecting their rights. So if they feel like their rights are being infringed on, then yes, they absolutely are going to take to the streets and show up for the cause that they feel passionate about.
And what if the Supreme Court gives it to Trump? What do the other side do?
There's absolutely going to be a lot of frustration there, I would agree. And I would say that you're going to see a lot more of those protests, especially if we see a repeat kind of like we did in 2000, where it comes down to those battleground states and it comes down to the Supreme Court. And especially if Trump's new nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, gets into the Supreme Court, and then all of a sudden she's one of the one casting those very deciding votes in his favor. And now all of a sudden we're looking at this and saying, wait a second, the American people are told that they have a voice and a vote, yet they're casting votes that then goes to the Electoral College, that then goes to the House of Representatives, that now suddenly goes to the Supreme Court. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really feel like you have that much of a voice when it's those elected representatives that are actually being the ones to cast that final vote, and they may have a dog in the race whenever it comes to their party.
Now, will he get that latest Supreme Court nomination? Can that go through the Senate in time? There's only, 22, 23 days left?
Well, they say that they're going to be resuming hearings in the coming week, and it sounds like it's something that Republicans are absolutely going to push for. So I could see them pushing it in, especially if we don't get any kind of new scandals or anything like that, specifically where she's concerned. It looks like they could make that happen, and then they could have that edge when it comes to the Supreme Court and the election.
Describe the economy for the moment, Rachel. I talked earlier about the unemployment numbers, the mass evictions, closures, and so on. What does it feel like in the United States, economically speaking?
There is still that level of frustration because right now you have states looking at rising COVID-19 cases and wondering, do we need to do another lockdown? How are we going to handle that? You know, New York was moving forward with reinstituting a second lockdown in some places. And so there is kind of that level of frustration of what is this going to look like? And there's also the question of, our kids going to be able to go back to school safely and stay in school? Are parents going to be able to still put food on the table? And you look at the fact that we have thousands of small businesses that went out of business and are still out of business and will never return. So there are a lot of Americans that are hurting right now. Now, in terms of what they see as the remedy of that, some of them see it as reelecting Trump. Some of them see it as electing and trying Joe Biden. There are a number of remedies there that they are considering, but I would say that there is a lot of frustration just from the average American about exactly what our future looks like and how certain it is.
Indeed. Now, the unemployment levels, the evictions, the closures of business, on top of the coronavirus, on top of the political uncertainty, it's a very rocky picture that we're painting here. Are we in danger of exaggerating it in any way?
You know, I don't think so, especially with everything that has happened this year, and especially when you look at just how polarized it seems to be. But yet, you look at these two candidates, you look at everything that has been said in these debates, and you realize there's a lot of places that Joe Biden and Donald Trump have a lot in common. So if Americans are getting frustrated, it's likely because they're watching everything that's happening in the media. They're watching the Democrats and Republicans in Congress not refusing to come together on anything that isn't how many hundreds of billions of dollars we're going to spend waging wars around the world next year. You know, and so they're feeling that rising, and they're feeling like no one is actually speaking for them. So this absolutely is something that could end up coming to a head, especially when you have those groups who are looking at each other as being on opposite sides of the aisle and not realizing that at the end of the day, they may actually have a lot in common, but they're just looking at this two-party system and thinking that those parties are absolute opposites.
Now, tell me about young Joe Biden. His performance in the first debate, his trousers didn't fall down, so he counted it as a success. And now he's effectively finished the debates by insisting that they be virtual debates rather than on a stage in person. I was sure that he would do that. I was amazed he didn't do it before the first one. Are there going to be any more debates? And what is likely to be the result of the cancellation of those debates? How will it change the dynamic in the election campaign still to run?
Well, right now they're saying that there's not going to be another debate because Biden wants it to be virtual. Trump doesn't want it to be virtual because he knows that that essentially gives them the power to mute his mic and that he won't be able to get in and say as much as he wants to. So I honestly don't see there being another debate. But as far as how that's going to impact the election, a lot of these people that have made up their minds already have their minds made up, and another debate isn't really going to change that. Now, what I will say is that the two groups that we really need to keep an eye on are the people who decide not to go out and vote at all, those people who say, it's not worth my time, it's going to be a similar outcome no matter what, especially when it comes to foreign policy, and those people who decide that they want to vote for a third party. Because, of course, the third parties were not allowed on these debates. It was only Trump and Biden. So there are a number of people that are saying, well, we're not too sure about these two candidates. What else is out there? Who else is on the ballots? And those are going to be the two groups of people that we really need to keep an eye on to see if Trump or Biden are going to be able to pass that threshold of getting 270 electoral votes and if they can secure that nomination without the help from the House of Representatives or the Supreme Court.
Are you prepared to make a prediction, Rachel?
I'm still going to say that I think it's going to be pretty close. I think it's going to, I could see Trump, you know, saying that he's in the lead on election day, and then I could see a little bit more coming around with the ballots with Joe Biden. I think that it's going to be one of those things where it may take a few days for us to know the actual outcome, and there are going to be a lot of people who don't agree with it, whichever way it goes.
I told you she was going to be a politician. Rachel Blevins, thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Thanks very much indeed. She's only 25, Rachel. She's one of the brightest stars in the firmament.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, we've been talking about the morons that are battling it out to be President of the United States. And someone said, what about our own morons? Well, the sharpest-eyed observer that I know of the morons on our own political scene is my good friend Patrick Christies, who has agreed to join us right now on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Patrick, it's not a pretty sight, the United States, but it's not that prettier at Westminster, is it? The government's handling of the coronavirus has been, A, completely ineffective. We're right back where we started, but not without spending vast, uncountable sums of money to no effect. And this governmental performance has gone entirely uncontested by the leader of the opposition, a large plank of wood called Sir Keir Starmer, so wooden the birds are trying to nest in him. And his idea of opposition is to go along with what the government says and does, and when it doesn't work, then criticize it. That's a pretty poor show, isn't it?
It's a very poor show all round, George. It's incredibly shambolic what we're dealing with at the moment in the United Kingdom. We've got this much-fated, political system here that's supposed to be world-leading, a little bit like our test and trace system was, and look how well that's gone so far. But yeah, so far, currently anyway, it looks like we don't really have too much leadership. We certainly don't have any opposition, and the parties that are in the squishy middle ground there basically might as well not exist. So it's not a particularly good moment for us at the minute. Boris Johnson, I've referred to him as behaving a bit like a high-pressure double-glazing salesman at the moment. He sends people round to tell you a bit how dangerous your conservatory and your life may well be. Then he sends in the rather handsome young chap in Rishi Sunak to tell you how much money he might be able to save you. And then, of course, he himself comes in and stings you with the cold, hard reality of making you sign up for something that you probably didn't need and indeed doesn't work in the first place. Boris is going to be making a huge swathe of announcements tomorrow and bring in this three-tier system that I'm sure we're going to go into in quite a lot of detail. But this will have disastrous effects for the country, both financially but also politically for Boris Johnson, because it's going to affect the vast majority of it anyway. It's going to affect the north of England, the very place that he smashed down Labour's red wall. And we are on the brink, I think, Georgia, of quite a worrying situation in this country where extreme.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Poverty breeds with it two things. It can breed with it extreme socialism. Okay, some people might not say that's that dangerous, but it tends to split people, and you know, can end up with extreme socialism and extreme nationalism. And when you have those two things whirring around simultaneously, it's not a particularly good thing for your country.
This observation you make about the red wall is the real political question now, because the red wall, these were rock solid Labour seats for generations after generations that fell to the Conservative Party in a large number of cases for the very first time in history. And yet these are the towns and cities that are now going to be devastated by a second tier, a second wave of lockdowns. Tell us what you think he's got in mind in tomorrow's announcements.
Yeah, well, supposedly what I'm hearing is that there'll be no mixing between households, even outdoors. Pubs could close, but restaurants will remain open. There's a bit of a grey area there, of course. People will be asked, I understand it, not to leave their local areas. Beauty salons may close, all right, that doesn't seem to affect me that much, George, but sports venues can shut as well, places like gyms, of course, which I know do affect a lot of people. An interesting one here, non-essential business may close. Well, non-essential is an interesting point, isn't it? Because for the people who own those businesses and work in them, you would imagine that they are deemed to be very, very essential. What he's doing here is trying to get Chancellor Rishi Sunak to come up with this job support scheme. It's going to pay somewhere in the region of 2/3 of people's wages, up to the value of around £2,100. It's not clear yet whether or not employers will be expected to top the rest of that up. But this is the main point, and this is the point that you raised there about the red wall, which is the areas that are going to be drastically affected by this now, which is, at what point did this start to go from something that was uncontrollable and out of our hands, i.e. the pandemic initially happening? No one could have foreseen what initially happened, and I think that's fair enough. But the government has had it's had months now. Exactly, to come up with a test and trace system that works, that's not happened, and to prepare the NHS. Now, we've been told anyway that there's been the equivalent of 50 new hospitals created, either through new Nightingale hospitals or through expanded space within existing hospitals. Well, actually, if that was the case and both of those things had worked, test and trace, and our hospitals being prepared, then surely we wouldn't have to be going into the kind of lockdown measures that we are expecting to be announced tomorrow. And this is where it will really cost him politically, because actually now it started to become the government's fault that we're here again, as opposed to this being something that was out of Boris's control.
Now, you know the Conservative Party well. This must be causing unrest inside the party. Boris Johnson's not the man he used to be. He was a kind of sunshiny figure, an effervescent, eloquent, funny fellow, but there's not much to laugh about now. And he seems like to have deflated. It's like a spitting image puppet that the air has been let out of. He's flat, his performances are flat, his government's actions have not worked, despite vast, eye-watering sums of money spent on them. £110 billion has been spent on the test and track and trace, and there's no sign of it anywhere, and it hasn't worked. Is there a possibility that the skids are under Johnson inside the Conservative Party?
Yes, there is, very much so, not least because of all the MPs who won their seats at the last election in the red wall that we've spoken about, now fearing that they're going to get kicked out of there quite unceremoniously at the next opportunity, of course. That applies pressure on Boris Johnson, but also from people towards the right of the party, MPs like Steve Baker, for example, who have been really concerned about the government's authoritative approach. There's been a bit of a question mark, really, over our fundamental democratic system in this country, with laws, and they are laws, and in some cases quite draconian laws, ever-changing, by the way, coming in and out and in again on a regular basis without parliamentary scrutiny, which is something that underpins UK democracy and underpins what we would deem normally to be, you know, kind of civilised nations, I suppose you could say. Well, that's not been happening. There's not been the scrutiny there, and there's not been parliamentary votes on it, and people have been struggling to get their heads around that, and that seems to be, frankly, very, very undemocratic. And so he is copping it from all angles, actually, at the moment, and that's worrying for Boris Johnson. And the fact is as well that it's the main issue, I think, for him, or one of the main issues for him, is the quality of advice that he's taking. You mentioned there about the kind of ray of sunshine that he was. Now, it's not fair to say that Boris Johnson is simply a fair weather prime minister, because the reason why he rode in on a wave of optimism was that he was intending to tackle and tackle well what is a very difficult issue for Britain, i.e. Brexit. And he kind of almost, in a way, planned that out and surrounded himself with advisers so he could delegate and do that. Well, now he's been confronted with this situation, and he clearly is relying very heavily on his advisers. And those advisers have come under scrutiny, frankly, for the quality of the advice that they've been giving and the basis of the research that they've been giving. Just recently, actually, in fact, I saw an article that came out on this today. Professor Chris Whitty, who's been one of the top medical officers there, of course, advising Boris Johnson, apparently told Cabinet, briefed Cabinet yesterday, that 33% of COVID transmissions in the United Kingdom had come from pubs and the hospitality sector. So they all kind of bought that, and that's been one of the main reasons behind why we might now close a lot of pubs and the hospitality sector, reducing millions of jobs there to ashes, essentially, and the industry as a whole. Well, that's now been questioned because it's emerged that the sample size that they used for that was essentially minimal and therefore doesn't really hold up much to scientific scrutiny. And so you've got Boris Johnson now, who doesn't appear to have any original ideas of his own, doesn't particularly want to take control of this himself, and perhaps is almost deliberately now at this point not taking the best of advice. And that really is a kind of potent cocktail of disaster for him, not just within his own party, but with the public as a whole.
And all of this running alongside the very difficult negotiations, they would have been difficult for anyone, with the European Union about the final status agreement. It's now coming up to the middle of October, and we're out on the New Year's Eve. So are we going to get an agreement with the European Union, in your view?
I think it's become almost impossible to say, but I'd have to say no, it doesn't look that way to me particularly at the moment, unless there can be several rabbits pulled out of the hat at a later date. It appears that Michel Barnier, who's of course the EU's chief Brexit negotiator there, is not for moving when it comes to things like fisheries, or really specifically fisheries, really. And that's providing an issue because clearly that was seen as being a major element of Brexit and actually not something that Boris Johnson specifically wants to compromise on. So that's a sticking point. The one saving grace that might happen, and there are noises that seem to be coming out about this, which is that EU leaders, heads of state there, around the block there, seem to be getting a bit twitchy about this now, perhaps want to marginalise Michel Barnier slightly and try to take control of things themselves. The question there, of course, is have we got enough time for that to happen? It also is the question, of course, is does Boris Johnson really actually want a deal, and at what cost? Certainly if it comes to not being able to seize competitive advantage, that seems to be a nonsense as far as personally I would be concerned, and I think most Brexiteers would be concerned. That isn't true independence, is it? Why would you want to go for that? And so it is looking unlikely for me that we would get a deal there, especially with everything else, of course, that is going on as well. And I just can't help but wonder whether or not Boris Johnson will try to actually use the no-deal element to play to his base. Again, we've spoken about this red wall, and actually a lot of those people there did vote for him because they were quite pro-Brexit areas, very pro-Brexit areas. And actually those people there, on the whole anyway, don't seem to be too worried anyway about a no-deal scenario. Is Boris Johnson trying to position himself as their hero in this capacity now? Sorry, guys, I've messed up the whole coronavirus things. Apologies about that. And I know you don't have a job to go to anymore. But hey, I didn't cave into the European Union, did I? And maybe that's something he's looking to hinge his hat on.
Who is the man in the shadows? Who is the man that it is possible to imagine would come forth and say, your time's up, Boris Johnson? You've made a cod of the whole thing, and it's time to go. Who would be the most likely successor to Boris Johnson, in your view?
It's a very interesting question, that, really. I think given the unprecedented economic disaster that we're about to face, actually, Rishi Sunak has been positioning himself relatively well. He has been kind of putting well-placed articles out at the right times, essentially saying, I'm kind of urging Boris not to do this. It wouldn't be financially prudent to do this. And therefore, when we are kind of picking through the charred remains of the British economy, and let's be honest, probably months now that were gone for years, perhaps Rishi Sunak could continue to position himself as the man who wished he hadn't had to do this and the man with the fiscal responsibility to get us out of it. I do think that there is a lack of real kind of seasoned class within that Conservative Party. You could argue that Michael Gove is always trying to be well positioned to take over from anyone. I mean, I think that's somebody who can't be written off there. But seriously, the Conservative Party are in trouble in that respect. There doesn't seem to be too many people that are lurking about there who would be in a position to go on and take it. It's interesting, isn't it? Because actually, my answer to this question would have been very different a few months ago. Gavin Williamson was somebody who perhaps could have been seen as this kind of slightly Machiavellian figure, or very Machiavellian figure behind the scenes, who maybe was manoeuvring towards power. That's been completely shot out of the window because of the abject disaster disaster he's made of our education system. Priti Patel was another one there who you maybe thought, could her time come? Absolutely not. She's been an absolute shambles when it's come to dealing with immigration and, frankly, anything Home Office related that this country's had to offer. There aren't too many people around there at the moment. And this touches on a point we made at the start as well, George, which is, OK, in that situation, then you argue that it's time for a change of government, don't you? That's the way things need to work. OK, fine. Well, Sir Keir Starmer does a very good job of putting on a nice suit and slicking his hair back. Is there any danger of finding out what any of his policies are anytime soon? Because I'd certainly like to know, and I think the nation would, there does seem to be a lack of class on the Labour benches as well. It's not good news for Britain, but it does provide absolute fodder for people like me who like to snipe from the sidelines.
Yeah, well, any other leader would have had Labour 20 points ahead, to coin a phrase, wouldn't they?
Yeah, this is it. There's an argument, or there was an argument anyway initially, for sitting back and allowing Boris to burn his own house down. But that moment now has been and gone, and now you need to provide a credible opposition. And that involves some things like credible solutions, alternatives at least, to the current state of affairs. It's not good enough for Sir Keir Starmer to simply say, actually, I agree with things like going back into a lockdown and this, that and the other. When actually it's so deeply unpopular with the electorate, he now is not going to be able, at the next election, whenever that may turn out to be, to say, I was opposing him all the way. Because he's on record every single Wednesday, pretty much, at PMQs now. He's on record agreeing with Boris's very haphazard approach to this. And this is what's strange, and this is what I think should be a concern just apolitically for the British people, which is, where is the leadership now? Where is the leadership? Where is that coming from? Are there no credible alternatives to this whatsoever? And is nobody prepared to stick their head above the parapet? Boris Johnson, of course, was billed himself anyway, as this slightly Churchillian figure. That's not happened, simply. Is there nobody else there who's willing to step up to the plate? And if there isn't, that does question what calibre of leader we might get in the future as well.
Patrick Christie, it's always a pleasure to hear your zest for the political scene in Britain. Thanks very much for joining us. Patrick actually worked with me in the week on one of my new projects that I've talked to you about before, looking at the ideological propaganda, economic, financial, and maybe hot war against China. Here's just a teaser of what Patrick and I were working on.
I'm standing on the site of the Great Exhibition of 1851. The great and the good of British society passed through here, and of course the star literary turn was Charles Dickens, the internationally renowned author. It was certainly the best of times for Dickens, but it was the worst of times for the people he wrote about, the poor. Dickens compared the might and muscle of British industry with what he referred to as the Little Exhibition, the Chinese one. The truth is that Dickens absolutely despised the Chinese, and by today's standards, there can be no question, he was a racist.
Charles Dickens, a racist? Whoa! You'll need to wait and see the rest of that video. Thank you, Patrick, indeed, for that. Stay tuned for that video, and it won't be the last of them. Let me take a 60-second break, why don't you?
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Andrew says the polls and media have done this with Trump and Brexit and general election predictions. They're all massively wrong. The only way Trump won't get back in is if he is wiped out or they fiddle with the postal vote. And Terry says many people are reluctant to admit they support Trump. He's despicable and they know it, so they keep it to themselves. And Lloyd says, interesting, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump did it again. His opponent is very wooden. That's an understatement. Darren says, they're called submarine voters. They pop up at the last minute and wreak destruction. And Michael says, Biden will win. People are fed up with the divisiveness and idiocy of Trump. They want a normal person in the White House who does not embarrass them every day with stupid tweets. And, well, you know, Biden's been in the US Senate for 47 years. He's a multimillionaire. I'm not sure how he qualifies as a normal person. Tony says, where I live in Virginia, they are college-educated and consider themselves middle class. They are voting for Trump for economic reasons, namely the stock market. Their retirement portfolios are looking good, and their taxes. They don't care what else he does, as long as they are doing well. For how long is anyone's guess? Good point, actually. Now, haunting us all night, indeed all day, and every day, is the coronavirus. We're going to deep dive into it now with Moat's medic, Dr. Ranjit Brar. Dr. Ranjit, thank you very much indeed for your time again. It's just as well this is not in America and we'd have to pay you because we couldn't afford you after so many months now of discussing this every week. And we will have a deeper dive into the coronavirus on Wednesday nights also on the midweek Moats. But let me start with an obvious question from the news there. How can Donald Trump no longer be a danger to anyone with the coronavirus? How is it possible that in the space of the week, you can test positive for the virus, be so ill you have to be helicoptered into hospital, but by the end of that week, you are officially no longer a danger and can summon people to your lawn and breathe all over them? That's not credible, is it?
Hi, George. Very good to be back with you. You're lucky that currently we still have a National Health Service, so I'm a very cheap doctor, George. I'm free at the point of delivery. So
free to air. Yes.
I won't be charging you all my patients happily anything, but that sadly is something that we can't rely on forever. In terms of your question, you know, I've been looking. I thought you might ask me something about this. We brought it up last week. I was looking at the cocktail of drugs that Trump has been given. Even the timing of his infection is not absolutely clear. He probably had it for as much as 3 days prior to the public announcement that he had the virus, which means that, as you say, he's someone who's continually around people and is very likely.
He tried to give it to Joe Biden, doctor.
It could very well have been the case. He's certainly given it to many members of his staff and many senior U.S. administration officials, military, police. You know, I'm absolutely sure that will be the case. He's been given a bunch of drugs, a cocktail of drugs. He's been given dexamethasone, which is a steroid, which is a well-known and has been shown in terms of intensive care to be good for patients who are extremely critically unwell, including those with COVID, though not necessarily, he doesn't really fit into that, but it's a possibly immunosuppressive drug. He's been giving Regeneron, which is a couple of synthetically produced antibodies which are supposed to target the spike protein of the coronavirus. That's an experimental drug which is not generally available. And that's the one he's been involved in some controversy for because he apparently also has links to the CEO. He probably has links to many CEOs, to be fair. But since he's announced that Regeneron is the wonder drug, he's a bit confused about what a therapeutic is. So he keeps on saying he doesn't call it a therapeutic, he calls it a cure. But this kind of PR that he's been giving to it has resulted in an increase in its share price, and there's some question of insider trading. But I think nothing will come of it, probably. He's also been given remdesivir, which is the antiviral we know about, produced by Gilead, which was again controversial because pretty much the whole of the supply, once it showed to be mildly effective and that it reduced the overall duration of infection of patients as a relatively new antiviral drug, was pretty much monopolized instantly just for US customers, though some doses have been getting out then further afield, including very few in the UK. But it's very tightly controlled because it's very limited supply. But anyway, a probable limited efficacy. And the trial, as we discussed briefly, has a number of factors which bring it into question. He's been given some vitamins. I have many people who think that, there's some element of conspiracy around the virus itself, said you simply have to take vitamins. And it's true to say that vitamin D, you know, along with zinc and vitamin C, vitamin D in particular is very good for the immune system. We probably know that the majority of patients who have tuberculosis in the Northern Hemisphere in Britain are patients who've had a chronic infection that's reactivated because they become vitamin D insufficient. And that's particularly the case with Afro-Caribbean and Asian population whose skin makes it hard for them to synthetically generate the active form of vitamin D, which is essentially a reaction which requires light, requires photons of specific energy to make vitamin D, and they become vitamin D deficient. So vitamin D is something that's available to everyone, and we've been recommended throughout this that if you want to boost your immune system, make sure you take plenty of vitamin D, particularly in the winter. In Britain, a large percent of the population will be deficient, so that's a good one. He's had melatonin, which is an interesting drug. It's actually a hormonal chemical released in the hippocampus, so a part of the brain near to the hypothalamus, and that actually is something that it regulates your diurnal rhythm, where what the body thinks is day and what the body thinks is night. But it also has anti-inflammatory properties, and as far as I can gather, I think that's been used to try and suppress this cytokine storm, just as the Cubans have themselves come up with several medicines which are known to do that. I guess it was considered in politic that he used that, so whether he has used the Cuban drug or not, I can't ascertain, but they've published a list of drugs that doesn't contain the Cuban medications. They've said he's taken melatonin, but probably to suppress the cytokine storm. He's taken aspirin. Aspirin is a drug which is very common. It's probably 3,000 years old. It's in the willow bark, of course. It's an antipyretic, but it's also slightly inactivates platelets in the blood, which makes them a bit less sticky. And we know that because this drug, because of the virus, causes these a vasculitis, if you like, and a high incidence of deep vein thrombosis and other effects, including strokes and all kinds of things. So arterial thrombosis, but particularly venous thrombosis, I think, you know, that would probably be the reason for that. And then he's been some H2 receptor antagonists, which are essentially antacids, the slightly older form of antacid before the date of proton pump inhibitors, but acting essentially on the protein pump, the proton pump, sorry, within the gastric mucosa to reduce the acidity of the stomach. It may simply just be, you know, in the case of a general drug, especially when he's taking aspirin, to limit the effects on the stomach. So a cocktail of drugs, including some experimental ones and antibodies which specifically target the virus, may well be responsible for a decrease in viral load. But I think you're absolutely right. There's no reason, you know, that the general instructions that we're given, which are, you know, if you have the virus, you should self-isolate for 14 days, should absolutely apply to Donald Trump. They've not published, as far as I'm aware, any kind of test to show that he's tested negative, and I think it's extremely unlikely that they'd be able to provide one under any circumstances. And in the presence of essentially an experimental drug which would be suppressing his titer of virus, it wouldn't necessarily prove that he was viral free anyway. So I think it's quite controversial that he's come out into general section.
Yeah, that he's out there. But I mean, the fact that he is out there, and I actually think that when he says that he feels better than he has for 20 years, I think he looks better than he did before he went in. And he is on the campaign trail. He's making speeches. He sounds coherent, or at least as coherent as he ever does, which is a different thing, I know. It seems to have worked, Doctor, no?
I mean, interesting, there are side effects of drugs. Dexamethasone is a drug which can induce mania. Trump probably...
Oh, my God!
You probably didn't need that. it can make you feel incredibly good. I mean, famously, if you give... rheumatologists who have to routinely dose their patients with steroids, sometimes high dose steroids, and there are serious side effects of them. But when they're initially given them, they feel incredible. They feel amazing. They come in and give away gifts to everyone. They sell, you know, it can be as bad as they sell their houses and try to give, you know, significant chunk of it. So it can be a real problem. But certainly, you know, you can feel incredibly good temporarily.
Euphoric.
Some of the medicines you're on. I don't think it necessarily implies that he's cured, but though I agree with you, he certainly doesn't look like he's in need of a respirator. So clearly the cocktail of drugs has done something for him. Certainly not a cocktail of drugs which is available to the general population who are suffering from this disease, who essentially are in the main being left just to languish and, you know, devil take the hindmost, being the philosophy.
Quite so. Now, in the limited time left, there's a brand new raft of restrictions, lockdowns, closures to be announced in the Westminster Parliament tomorrow. They've already been announced in Scotland, and they're going to be announced in Liverpool, in parts of the Northwest. How serious is that? Does that imply the viral spike has become?
Well, I think it's very serious. If you just look at testing, it seems that our current wave dwarfs the previous wave. But of course, last time we had far fewer tests available. So they thought it was a one-off that there were like about 12,000 cases. But we've had a weekly average of average per day of in excess of 15,000 cases test proven, which implies there's a far greater number in the community. If you look at hospitalizations, we're up to 600 hospitalizations per day. If you look at total number of hospital beds occupied, we're in the realm of 4,000, but that can rapidly increase. And of course, at the height of the pandemic in March, we had only probably 16,000 occupied. If you look at ventilator beds occupied by COVID patients, then currently we're looking at around 500 ventilated patients with COVID, and the a disproportionate number, about a quarter of those, are in the Northwest, which is why they're talking about tiered restrictions. I think all of the restrictions essentially are a sign of failure. They're a sign that we have failed to adequately locate the virus and eliminate it from our population. And as I've repeatedly said, this should have been achievable, realizable, achievable, realistic, if we'd use the NHS and this very simple measures of, human contact, using our human manpower within the NHS, not superseding it, not going around it, not privatizing it, not running it down, not reducing its capacity, but boosting the NHS, really protecting the NHS means putting all the funds back into it, increasing its staff, which is sort of beleaguered, increasing its hospital number of beds, which have been run down. And then we'll be able to cope not just with this pandemic, but with all of the many health problems that we are ignoring because of this pandemic, George.
Brilliantly expressed. Thank you very much, Doctor. Bit short of time this evening. Thank you again for joining us. I like to finish the show every week with the legend that is Norma in Bristol. Norma, welcome back.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Not a lot of time. I've just got 3 points.
Go ahead.
First one is the ear gate. Because of my ear.
Ah, yes, about the... You were deaf on one side and your husband was deaf on the other side, as I recall.
Well,
perfect
anyway,
marriage. Perfect marriage, Norma. I often pretend I'm deaf in one ear.
Oh, that's a male thing, that is.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But quickly, I did have to pay £90 for my two ears and £24 in taxis. And my surgery is only 5 minutes away, so that's then I can hear. The next point, George, because we haven't got much time, is, this Moats Extra on Wednesday?
Yes.
Well, I'm a bit concerned about putting my bank card details onto the computer or Facebook. Uh-huh. Is there any other way that we can
You can
pay?
Do it on Patreon. You don't have to do it on Facebook.
I don't know what Patreon is.
Look it up, Patreon and / George Galloway. It's very easy to find. It's easier.
All right. All right.
And you can pay $5 a month, which is, about
£4
maybe, just a bit over, for a whole month. And you can look back at previous editions and so on. Whereas if you're on Facebook, it's pay-per-view, 65 pence for English people, $1 for Americans.
It's not the money, George. It's putting my details.
I know. But you do it, presumably, to buy things online, don't you?
I'm a bit nervous about it, really.
Really?
I am nervous about it.
Well, I hope there's not too many nervous people or the show will be a flop.
It wouldn't
be a show without you, Norma.
Listen, and the last point is, this lady, Annie, was the lady that was...
The singer-songwriter, yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, we have booked a piano recital on Wednesday afternoon at St. George's Hall in Bristol, and it's the first time they've opened up, and hopefully we will go.
How is that going to work, Norma?
Presumably,
you sit there and there's two empty seats, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe three, and then someone else. I see no problem with that, you see.
Well,
that's what happens. It's actually better than what happens. when you get on a bus or you get on the train or you go into the co-op.
And it'll make a nice change, George, just to get out, you know?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I am feeling culturally starved. I really am.
No sound it, you don't sound it.
Norma,
yes.
I hope you can overcome your nervousness about booking up for the show on Wednesday. But I hope very much, because people said they wanted an extra show. Let's see if they truly meant it. I certainly feel that there's a void in the middle of the week. I am frequently frustrated that I cannot get the megaphone and reach the mass audience around the world in midweek, and Sunday to Sunday is not sufficient. That's my view. We'll see if it is the view of others. So Moats Extra begins on Wednesday on Patreon, on my Patreon page, or on my Facebook page. That is George Galloway Official. It's been marvellous for me, and if it was for you, I hope you'll be back next week at the same time in the same place. Until then, may God go with you all, and may we all gather again on Wednesday and on Sunday. Thanks very much for being here.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.